Now, if you're in the back, let me give you a little clue. It's better up here.
Yeah. You can turn the microphone toward you.
This is where the glory is. So if you want to come up, that'd be good. If you don't, you're welcome to sit there. I told the group yesterday morning, if you look under your seats, if there's a letter A on it, you get bucked out of there. So it might be good to move up while you still can. Your call. Thank you. On the lights. Well, good morning. We don't have the rain this morning. That's kind of a nice thing. This is just down to a real light drizzle. They came at the wrong time. It was bitter cold. The trees and plants had already dropped their summer and fall garb. The grasses and wildflowers had given up their carpets of color and assumed that they're winter brown until God calls them forth again next spring. The trees, now without their leaves, opened the sky to the sight and sound of hawking geese flying south, as if to say, it's going to get colder. Get out while you can. The babbling brook that ran to water's edge gave them a chill, knowing this is where they are likely to go when they gather water. The tulips of Holland are now a fading memory, and the vista of the New England shoreline demands their focus, as if to say, pay attention. This is where you're going to likely pay attention. This is where you're going to live, or at least try. And overlooking the entire scene was one of those skies you've all seen often, and that is a snow sky. And now in their shallop, they get closer and closer to the shoreline. There it is, that big rock. Sure, pull the boat up to that rock. It's a good place to step off onto something firm and solid instead of being on a storm-tossed ship they had called home for more than 9 weeks. To them, it was just a rock. In the pilgrim's eye, probably as much as any other rock. But to us, it's Plymouth Rock. From there, they would take their first baby steps in the new world. What lay in front of them was not at all like what they expected. Never before has so much been required from so few and had so little. From this humble and courageous beginning came a legacy that changed the world. These incredible people with more faith than many front before them came to establish a way of life that could cause nations to stand up and take notice. Some nations would be amazed and inquire why and how. Other nations would close their borders and protect their way of life from any such intrusion. Let's take a look at history, where religious persecution was front and center in the minds of society because the Reformation had made a huge impact on faith. Before they ever left England, this group of English men and women had reasoned among themselves, using Scripture as their guide, that they could no longer remain in the Church of England and had to separate themselves from what they felt was a hopeless situation. Without getting into a lot of church history, King James had declared himself to be the head of the church and had the divine right to do whatever he wanted. Setting himself up as God on earth was kind of in direct conflict to what they believed.
Kind of.
After many years of turmoil, the average citizen was finally able to obtain a Bible and read for themselves exactly what Christ had taught his followers. They learned that Christ was the head of the church, which put them at odds with the dictates of the day. The king had actually declared himself to have the divine right, which they believed Scripture did not verify, validate, or endorse. On top of them, these people, under the direction of their pastor, John Robinson, had to flee for their lives. They were being hunted down like criminals and imprisoned. Eventually, they were released, even though they wouldn't submit, but by then, the pilgrims decided to move to Holland. It was perhaps the only country in the world at that time where they could raise their families according to their beliefs. First, they moved to Amsterdam for a year and then on to Leiden, altogether totaling 12 years. The move was hard, but at least they could worship freely, no more nightly raids or imprisonments. Their numbers continued to grow to almost 300. The years spent there were hard. They had to learn a new language, find work in textiles and other trades which they weren't accustomed to, and everyone, even the children, had to work to survive. They even realized that the long arm of the English law could reach them in this chosen land, even though they were 350 miles away. With these and many other things, including potential war with Spain, pressing in on them, they began to consider other possibilities. Remaining in Holland would not be a long-term solution. The Dutch were good to receive them in their time of need, and even they realized what a remarkable group of people the Pilgrims were, for they were hard-working and dependable. But when all was said and done, the Pilgrims wanted to raise their children without this present cultural influence and still be in English. They desired to retain a measure of their heritage. With this in mind, they lifted their eyes to God and sought direction. Over time, all things seemed to point in the direction of the New World, 3,500 miles away. Looking for a way to make something happen through the series of maneuvers with help from two of their own, they went back to King James, asking if he would send them to the New World. This he was willing to do in order to, quote, get rid of them and their annoying ways, unquote. So in April 1606, he wrote them a charter, and they made plans to relocate. Interestingly, one from whom they actually were fleeing, the king, was the one who was now paying their freight to get him out of his life. With the help of some unknown at the time, unethical people, they were able to arrange passage using two ships, the Speedwell and the Mayflower. After their first attempt, they discovered the Speedwell was neither speedy or well. It was leaking badly. After repairs were made, they tried again, but the Speedwell was once again leaking badly, causing a two-month delay. One of the Lincoln's quotes, not talking specifically about the Speedwell, but he said, there is nothing to be learned from the second kick of the mule. If the Speedwell didn't work the first time, it's not likely to work the second time. With these concerns, they determined that the Speedwell was too risky a venture. At this point, with some deciding to stay behind, the Mayflower, leaving late in the season with the newly shuffled passenger list, proceeded on alone. Now think back to what we talked about just a few minutes ago. It was cold. Wrong time of the year. The trip across the Atlantic had been brutal and uncertain. The future was ahead of them. Staring at the coastline, you can easily imagine how they felt. What's the first thing you would do? What's the first thing these beleaguered souls did? Well, they got on their knees and prayed, thanking God for a good land and a safe passage. The Pilgrim came as a church and migrated as 24 family units. There were 15 single men, 15 hired servants, 18 adult women, 29 children, ranging from 1 to 17, and 70% of the women died in the first winter. By the time of harvest, only 4 adult women were alive. With this in mind from the very beginning, even before they left homes they had ever known, and peering down through the centuries, their mission was always the same. Establish and develop this as a Christian land. These people, the Pilgrims, wanted to worship God freely and build a society on Judeo-Christian principles and biblical teaching. These people were children of the Protestant Reformation. They fled intense persecution. They did not hide their faith. They fully embraced it. They believed that a society could be developed in an area of life by following Scripture. They just needed a place with complete freedom to do that. It could be anyone, it could be anywhere, but with God's divine inspiration and direction, they chose here. That is why they left everything they held dear and ventured forth across this treacherous sea for 66 days to make it happen. The Pilgrims made it perfectly clear after being blown 250 miles off course. They ever stepped off the Mayflower with the compact they signed. Before they stepped off the Mayflower with the compact they signed and the leader they chose, that their intent was to establish order and conduct life by following scriptural principles taught to them by their leader and pastor, John Robinson, one of the top theologians of the day. He's related to Paul. Remember, there were two groups of people aboard the Mayflower, saints and strangers, and not everyone was a Pilgrim believer, but 41 men agreed to sign the compact and to abide by it. Is that not true today? We live under the rules that governs us, whether we agree with them specifically or completely or not. On that sea-drenched ship is where self-rule began. Before they ever got off, they signed that Mayflower Compact, which was actually the beginning of the American Republic. And to some, it was considered the Pilgrims' Declaration of Independence. This established a civil government promising just and equal laws. By signing this compact, it showed that they agreed to be governed by mutual consent. From then on, the compact was repeated as a preamble to every subsequent edition of their laws for decades. Much too can be gleaned by looking at their leader, William Bradford, who became the governor of Plymouth after John Carter died in the first year. Bradford spoke of all of this and so much more in his book Of Plymouth Plantation. He was a self-taught scholar who mastered Latin and Greek, could speak Dutch, and managed French, but he studied Hebrew the most. You guys good with that? Keep it up. He was also skilled in history, antiquity, philosophy, and theology, and it was said he was calm and courageous, an able leader indeed. Listen to one of the reasons Bradford gave for leaving Holland and going to the New World. Lastly, and which was not the least, a great hope and inward zeal they had of laying some good foundation, or at least to make some way thereunto for the propagating and advancing the kingdom of Christ in those remote parts of the world, yea, though they should be not even as stepping stones unto others for the performing of so great a work. Bradford is also known, just like Washington, for giving up power and putting it back in the hands of the people. Washington did it after the War for Independence and two terms as president, each time returning power to the people. Bradford did so after the 1621 Pierce Patent, which gave him total control and ownership of the colony. In these examples, self-government was always a cornerstone of what both men were trying to establish. Bradford was governor for 36 years. Aren't you glad we got away from that kind of thing? 2 years, two terms is enough. We cannot tell the Pilgrim story without looking at the Puritans, for in many ways they were one and the same. For the Puritans, the simplest way to explain their vision was with the words of their leader, John Winthrop, in his composition titled A Model of Christian Charity. We are entered into covenant with him for this work. We must be knit together as one. Basically, it was a covenant with God and one another. Love God with all your heart, your neighbor as yourself. Get those right, and society has a great chance of survival or being light in the world. Winthrop believed that this form of civil government by mutual consent would work because they entered into a covenant with God vertically and each other horizontally. Both of these men adhered to and honored for them to function properly. This became the definition of covenant love. This ranks in importance with the Mayflower Compact. The Pilgrims arrived first and were there for 10 years before the Puritans began coming to these shores. For 10 years, the Pilgrims had time to walk out their reason for being. With John Winthrop as their governor, the majority of the Puritans began to arrive in June of 1630. Over time, as many as 20,000 came, which was referred to as the Great Migration. John Winthrop believed they were to build upon the Pilgrims had started, as well as develop their work, which they were called to do. Both the Pilgrims and the Puritans believed the truth they understood from the Bible, but the walking out of it wasn't always easy, and the implementation over time was challenging. Just like those who followed them, the debates at times were difficult, heated, and even separated them for a while. But the end result brought clarity. They took biblical concepts and truth and applied them in real time to real life. They made mistakes along the way, but learned from them, and we're still doing that today. Let's look at what some of these two groups of people believed. Both the Pilgrims and the Puritans believed all things in life are governed by providence. Moving on, they believed that we were all made in the image of God. And if that was true, then all men are created equal. Lincoln said this about our Declaration of Independence, equal. So I think the authors of that notable instrument intended to include all men, but they did not mean to declare all men equal in all respects. They did not mean to say that all men were equal in color and size, intellect, moral development, or social capacity. They defined with tolerable distinctness in what they did not, what they did consider all men were created equal. Equal in certain inalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. This they said and this they meant. They did not mean to assert the obvious untruth that all were then actually enjoying that equality, or yet they were about to confer upon them immediately. In fact, they had no power to confer such a boon. They simply meant to declare the right so that the enforcement of it might follow as fast as circumstances should permit. They believed that God spoke to each individual first and then to the king, in that order. God, people, king. Personal responsibility is where everything began. Governing oneself and answer to God and proceed from there to a large arena. This was address accountability. They believed they would one day stand before God and give an account for their own life. They believed that government began in the heart of the individual. The more you govern yourself, the less civil government would need to take actions against you. Start with the heart and proceed outward. There would be less need for expansive government. It's interesting, Benjamin Rush, one of our signers and great founders, signer of the Declaration, had this to say: if we were to remove the Bible from public schools, we would be wasting so much time punishing crime and taking so little pains to prevent them. What he was saying, if you don't have crime, you can have limited government. More crime, more government. They believed that virtue and morality were found in the Bible. That was their moral code. Franklin said, only a virtuous people are capable of freedom. As nations become corrupt and vicious, they have more need of masters. They believed that no one was above the law, biblical law. Did you know that the scribe during the Revolution War was no king but Jesus? Which became one nation under God. They did not believe in bowing to an earthly king. In fact, our Constitution prohibits titles of nobility. Shouldn't have a czar in our government today. They believed no one was above that biblical law. They believed that religious liberty precedes civil liberty. John Adams said the general principles on which the fathers achieved independence were the general principles of Christianity. I will avow that I then believed and now believe that these general principles of Christianity are eternal and immutable as the existence and attributes of God. They believed the power was in the hands of the people, we the people. They believed equal justice under law. The farmer of the leader judged the same. No one was above the law. They believed if you don't work, you don't eat. Laziness or status was not legitimized. We aren't a layered society here. Benjamin Franklin, about poverty, said, I am for doing good to the poor, but I think the best way of doing good to the poor is making them eat uneasy in poverty, but leading or driving them out of it. I observed that the more public provisions were made for the poor, the less they provided for themselves, and of course became poorer. William Bradford, after watching the people suffer hardships under a failed system, dispensed with communal living, which had been set up for them in their charters. They didn't work. People were near starvation. Instead, he chose a different path for those under his leadership, using everyone's individual gifts and talents to create a free system of trade that finally brought an end to hunger and grumbling when working for themselves. They believed in the right to own property, which land Bradford gave to each family according to their need. This later was defined differently and became pursuit of happiness. Puritan Reverend Thomas Hooker believed that every man had the right to vote, which became one man, one vote. And he also believed in checks and balances. There are other beliefs the Pilgrims built upon, but by these alone, a picture for our founding era is emerging. We can see the influence they had on America with their arrival at Plymouth to today. One last thing before we move on. There were strong believers in education. I've got some books up here, but one I did not bring was about 400 years of education in America. And we're all adults. We've all gone through school or college or doctorates, whatever. But you look at some of the test questions for math 400 years ago, and I admit I can't do too well on the scoring. And when they would grade you or test you, you just stood. You couldn't write anything down. You had to listen, understand what they were saying when they described the test question to you. My lovely wife loves test questions. And she doesn't like math much better than that. In 1642, the Massachusetts General Court compelled settlers to teach. I keep looking that way because my good friend Mimi's going to come down at some point. So, okay, time's up. So rather than let her come and show me the hook, I'll just walk off the stage. 5 years later, they passed the Old Deluder Satan Law. This is here in Massachusetts, that required when a town reached 50 householders, They were required to appoint a teacher who can teach reading and writing. And when the town reaches 100, they were to start a grammar school. John Adams put it this way: liberty cannot be preserved without a general knowledge among the people. And if liberty can't be preserved without education, and he was all for education, as were the founders. When talking about history, we sometimes differ in our conclusions because we don't have the full picture. I don't have to lie to you. I just don't tell you the whole story. Here's an example of what I mean. A few years back, I was reading a book my lovely wife had got for me about the Mayflower Compact. Let me read some of the deleted words to see if you can find the recurring thing. So there's a book, I'm reading about the Mayflower Compact, and there are some words missing. Here are some of the missing words. In the name of God, amen. By the grace of God.
Amen.
Well, that's not in there, though.
No, God is in there.
That's right. Having undertaken for the glory of God and advancement of the Christian faith. Any idea how long the Mayflower Compact is? It's 200 words.
Yeah.
Any idea how many this author took out? One-third. 66 words are missing. Now, I got a lady here who says, yeah, what's missing is the he dot, dot, dot it. And that's exactly what he did. But if I walk out of this place and I go to the next town and share the same stories, they would not know that the Mayflower Compact doesn't have those words in it. You guys are sharper than the other ones. You're from here, a lot of you. And you know the Mayflower Compact. You may have cut your teeth on the Mayflower Compact. And so you understand those words. But what about the other words? What about in the name of God at the very beginning? Well, he chose to take that out. He deletes one-third of the total document. The compact is only 200 words. It takes 66 out. It's his book. He can decide what to leave out. But it's one thing when you're writing fiction and you want to leave something out. But when it's history, that's a little different. We expect the book to be accurate history. Otherwise, it's just another book of fiction. But that's what we're reading today. It's fiction. It's made up. The bad news is there probably are a few of you in here who would know they're missing. Thomas Paine said this: when men yield up the privilege of thinking, the last shadow of liberty quits the horizon. Depending on what book you read, Hitler said, what good fortune for governments that people don't think.
Right.
Jamestown was settled along the Virginia coast 13 years ahead of Plymouth. This may surprise you, but in Jamestown as well in Plymouth, the intent was the same. Both charters carried much the same message. Have any of you visited Jamestown?
Yes.
You go to Jamestown, and what you hear is, they'll tell you that the men and boys came looking for gold. They came looking for gold, and that's the reason that we have Jamestown settlement. Now look, everybody wants some gold. If I said there's gold over in the corner, we're all going to race over to the corner. I'm not going to race because my granddaughter would beat me. I used to be able to outrun my granddaughter. Can't do it anymore. But the original charter in 1606 doesn't exactly list the efforts to find gold as top priority. If you read the charter, and you can, it's online, it's April 1606 charter, what you find is this. The first two paragraphs list the names of the men and boys who are coming. The third paragraph lists the reason they are coming to Virginia. And spoiler alert, it's not gold. The third paragraph lists those reasons in darkness, and they say that it's not gold. But here's what it says: propagating of Christian religion to such people as yet live in darkness and miserable ignorance of the truth, knowledge, and worship of God. That's their mission statement. Kind of sounds just like the Pilgrim's mission statement. Spreading the gospel, and just so it's clear, the third paragraph talks only about spreading the gospel. And they do it in one sentence, so it's really easy to understand. Then you read the fourth paragraph, fifth, sixth, seventh, and eighth paragraph, and finally get to the ninth paragraph, where it says, yo fellas, great if you had some time to find some gold. That's what the document says. The other thing they typically don't mention at Jamestown is this. When they landed at Jamestown, May 13, 1607, that's true, but the rest of the story is the hidden treasure. Failure to mention it, and it fades into the past. The story is Cape Henry, a speck on the Atlantic coastline, where we had first landed 2 weeks earlier on April 27th, a spot on the beach where they came, erected a cross, where Reverend Hunt dedicated the land to God, and where he thanked God for their safe crossing. Now, there isn't a lot at Cape Henry, but there is a cross you can still go and see. But you won't hear that at Jamestown proper. You see the sleight of hand, unless asked, they will make no mention of Cape Henry, no mention of a cross, and no mention of Reverend Hunt. And I've been the antagonizer a couple times, which raised my hand and said, isn't this the bunch who built a cross, erected a cross, out on Cape Henry? Sir, we need to move along. Another thing you won't hear at Jamestown is when the slave traders arrived at Plymouth in 1646, the pilgrims arrested the slave traders and freed the slaves. Perhaps because the pilgrims stopped slavery cold and the movement to abolish it was strong in the New England colonies. In fact, this state, Commonwealth, ended the institution in 1783, 50 years before England ended slavery. Additionally, the pilgrims purchased land from the Native Americans. They did not steal it. They also signed a peace treaty that lasted for more than 50 years. I don't have to lie. I just don't tell you the whole story. As new folks arrived, the country grew. God's hand remained upon them who sought to honor him with their lives and talents. But as time went on and people poured in from different countries, bringing their varied beliefs and cultural differences, it became more difficult for the faith and traditions of those first arrivals to transform their small towns and villages to larger cities. It would be naive of me to suggest that our ancestors were perfect animals. They were not. But it appears when they strayed from the principles of their forefathers that God was not far from them and chose to honor the covenant they had made with him. Two great awakenings came when the light here began to dim. They were decades apart but seemed to carry the same weight and impact. The people's hearts were stirred again and the core beliefs of those arrivals rose to the top as those things of significance tend to do. A French historian, Francis Guizot, asked James Russell, who was a U.S. lawyer and editor, how long will the American Republic last? He replied, as long as the ideas of the men who founded it continue to dominate. Another award-winning quote from John Adams, statesmen, my dear sir, may plan and speculate for liberty, but it is religion and morality alone which can establish the principles upon which freedom can securely stand. The only foundation of a free constitution is pure virtue, and if this cannot be inspired into our people in a greater measure than they have it now, they may change their rulers and their forms of government, but they will not be able to obtain a lasting liberty. They will only exchange tyrants and tyrannies. Like children learning to walk, God knew they would stumble along the ways, but if they would return to their original love and covenant, and in their words repent and ask for forgiveness for their errors, God would help them make things right. It's another of their beliefs. When Jonathan Edwards and George Whitefield in the First Great Awakenings, this is what was going on through our history. First Great Awakening brought revival and renewed understanding of the forefathers' faith. Edwards is probably most famous for his sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, and newspapers called Whitefield the Marvel of the Age. I said no titles in the country, but he wasn't here. So, Marvel of the Age. He preached more than 18,000 sermons to approximately 10 million hearers, with some crowds as large as 30, 40, 50,000 at a time. He traveled more than 15,000 miles, excluding 13 trips across the Atlantic. He wore out 4 horses and 2 Mercedes. To John Witherspoon, signer of the Declaration as president of Princeton, he taught many of our founding fathers. It's kind of a who's who list of them. President Madison, vice president, 3 Supreme Court justices, 13 governors, 20 senators, and 30 congressmen. Noah Webster, who brought a common language to America by studying 26 languages over the course of 28 years to give us his 1828 American Dictionary of the English Language. His dictionaries contained 70,000 words. 1 in 6 were new words and included more than 6,000 biblical definitions. Webster also wrote his Blueback Speller, which has sold more than 100 million copies and is still in print. To Patrick Henry, mouthpiece of the Revolution, that man who asked for liberty or death, who said he was not a Virginian, but an American, a candle for starting fires. To Benjamin Rush, signer of the Declaration of Independence, stayed in Philadelphia to care for the sick when other doctors fled during the yellow fever epidemic in 1793. Thomas Jefferson, primary author of the Declaration of Independence, his Louisiana Purchase, his care for the land and its people were specific instructions to Lewis and Clark to treat the Native Americans well. T.J. was especially interested in the Indian nations on the frontier, and he instructed Lewis and Clark to treat the natives in the most friendly and conciliatory manner. Lewis was to warn any tribes that he stayed with in winter about smallpox and leave medicine for them to treat. He also told them to invite a few of the influential chiefs to come and see T.J. in Washington, and to have them conveyed to this place at the public expense. Daniel Webster, the great orator, attorney, and politician of the early 1800s, was here for the 200th anniversary. Charles Finney of the Second Great Awakening, he brought much-needed course correction and social reform. Formed the benevolent empire with a budget that rivaled the federal government's budget in 1834. No chance of anybody ever rivaling our government again. Concerning the kingdom of God, every member must work or quit. Formed the Oberlin College and was involved in the Underground Railroad. To Harry Beecher Stowe, her book Uncle Tom's Cabin influenced the Civil War. Abraham Lincoln had the opportunity to meet her and said, "So you're the little lady who's caused all this story." Abraham Lincoln, who wrote the Gettysburg Address and his second inaugural address, became two of the greatest. It was about saving the Union, but it became all men are created equal. To Dwight David Eisenhower, who put under God in our pledge of allegiance to this country, and also added in God we trust into law in 1956, 2 years after pushing the phrase and adding it to the Pledge of Allegiance. To Julia Ward Howe, who wrote the Battle Hymn of the Republic, writing the words down when they came to her in a dream while staying at the Willard Hotel in Washington during the Civil War. Generationally, these people were keepers of the covenant. The report from the Congressional House of Judiciary Committee in 1854 said this: "In this age there can be no substitute for Christianity. That was the religion of the founders in the Republic, and they expected it to remain the religion of their descendants. Had the people during the Revolution had a suspicion of any attempt to war against Christianity, that revolution would have been strangled in its cradle. Our charters of freedom, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights didn't just magically appear. They had been built upon the words and beliefs of the Pilgrims and the Puritans for generations." Here's a quote what T.J. said about the Declaration of Independence. "This was the object of the Declaration of Independence, not to find out new principles or new arguments that have never before been thought of, not merely to say things which have never been said before, but to place before mankind the common sense of the subject in terms so plain and firm as to command their assent and to justify ourselves in that independent stand we are compelled to take. It was intended to be an expression of the American mind." He also said when they were working on the Constitution, "With all the defects of our Constitution, whether general or particular, the comparison of our governments with those of Europe is like a comparison of heaven and hell." And although not a signer, Lincoln, after 85 July 4th, stops in Philadelphia to raise a flag over Independence Hall, and had this to say about the document as he made his way to Washington for his first inauguration: "I'm filled with deep emotion at finding myself standing here in this place where there are collected together the wisdom, the patriotism, the devotion to principle from which sprang the institutions upon which we live. The sentiment in the Declaration of Independence which gave liberty not alone to the people of this country, but I hope to the world for all future time. It was that which gave promise that in due time the weight would be lifted from the shoulders of all men. This is a sentiment embodied in the Declaration of Independence. Now, my friends, in this country be saved upon that basis. If it can, I will consider myself one of the happiest men in the world. But if this country cannot be saved without giving up that principle, I was about to say I would rather be assassinated on this spot than surrender it. And 150 miles away, and 50 months later, the unthinkable happened. So then to recap, our founders acted on the principles of the Pilgrims and Puritans. Jonathan Edwards, George Whitefield, and Finney, they preached it. John Witherspoon taught it. Patrick Henry declared it. George Washington fought for it. Thomas Jefferson wrote it to the world. Dr. Benjamin Rush practiced it. Lewis and Clark researched and shared it with the Native Americans. Noah Webster put it into his vocabulary and his dictionary, so Harriet Beecher Stowe could write about it and stir the emotions of thousands against slavery. So Abraham Lincoln, in a painful chapter of our history, reminded us of it. Martin Luther King dreamed of its fulfillment. And today, we still sing about it. When the Continental Congress appointed Washington as president of the Federal Convention, he opened with his statement, "Let us raise a standard to which the wise and honest can repair." I love that. Wise and honest can repair. The event is in the hands of God. On that day, September 17, 1787, that was the same day we signed our Constitution, the same day the rest of the globe was spinning at its normal 1,000 miles per hour. For 95% of the world's population, life was hard. And freedom was a mystical word that they had only heard about. And in some countries, it was best not to speak about. On that day, the absolute monarch of the Manchu dynasty reigned supreme over the people of China, and he ruthlessly squashed any resistance. On that day, our Constitution guaranteed us freedoms unknown by the vast majority of the people around the world. On that day, we learned we could dream about our future life in America. On that day, while people in foreign nations never knew any better, we were enjoying freedoms like less than 5% of the world has ever experienced. What those 55 men at the convention did was unprecedented, unknown to the world. The only precedent was that at least similar was established thousands of years before by the tribes of Israel and their covenant with God and each other. And it was that precedent that guided them in July 1776 when 56 men signed the Declaration of Independence, and in 1787 when 39 men signed the Constitution. The ideals espoused in both documents was a new thing coming directly from the Pilgrims and Puritans. Benjamin Rush said, "I do not believe that the Constitution was the offspring of inspiration, but I am as satisfied that it is as much the work of divine providence as any of the miracles recorded in the Old and New Testament." Washington said he viewed it as little short of a miracle. Franklin believed that its writings had been influenced, guided, and governed by that omnipotent, omnipresent, and beneficent ruler in whom all inferior spirits live and move and have their being. "Thus I consent, sir, to this Constitution, because I expect no better, and because I am not sure that it is not the best," said Franklin. Plymouth historian James Baker said this about the Pilgrims: "They came neither as conquerors nor as fortune hunters, but as families seeking spiritual liberty, civic freedom, and prosperity in a new world. Just like the multitudes that have followed them, the Pilgrims were poor in worldly wealth, but rich in faith and sober, hardworking and honest in their dealings. As the first examples of the American dream, they represent the humble virtues and strengths that have made America the nation it is today." So it's decision time. We need to decide as a country if what we want, if we want to continue this or not. It is our heritage, and we need to determine what legacy we will leave behind. And today we have all come to this beachhead named Plymouth and come to celebrate and appreciate what took place here, and remember the sacrifice of the Pilgrims. They came at the right time. It was the right time all along. It was the right time because the Pilgrims showed up here in Plymouth. It was the right time because the colony had been growing and laughter of a child could be heard. It was the right time because we had won the war for independence and Congress was drafting the Constitution for us. It was the right time when President Lincoln pushed to end slavery in America. It was the right time the Civil War ended, even though it meant Lincoln's wish at Independence Hall. See, there I'm going to make it. It was the right time when the Civil War ended, even though it meant Lincoln's wish at Independence Hall came true. But oh, how we wish it hadn't happened. And today, as we glance back at our history, we realize how far we have come. Daniel Webster and Calvin Coolidge both came here on the 200th and 300th anniversary. Daniel Webster said this in December for the 200th, 1820. Finally, let us not forget the religious character of our origin. Our fathers were brought hither by their high veneration for the Christian religion. They journeyed by its light and labored in its hope. They sought to incorporate its principles with the elements of their society and to diffuse its influence through all their institutions, civil, political, or literary. Let us cherish these sentiments and extend this influence still more widely in the full conviction that this is the happiest society which partakes in the highest degree of the mild and peaceful spirit of Christianity. In the 300th anniversary, Calvin Coolidge, they came undecked with orders of nobility. They were not children of fortune, but of tribulation. Prosecution, not preference, brought them hither. But it was a persecution in which they found a stern satisfaction. They cared little for titles, still less for their goods of this earth, but for an idea, they would die. Measured by the standards of men of their time, they were the humble of the earth. Measured by later accomplishment, they were the mighty. In appearance, weak and persecuted, they came. Rejected, despised, an insignificant band, in reality strong and independent. A mighty host of whom the world was not worthy, destined to free mankind. No captain ever led his forces to such a conquest, oblivious to rank, yet men traced to them their lineage as to a royal house. And today the message is the same, passed down from generation to generation. The message may have become faint or less talked about, but it is still here. How is it that we have become confused as to what has happened to America? Are we not looking again at who we are choosing to follow? Do we look up as our forefathers did to God, or now to man's leadership? Do we want inalienable rights from God, or the shifting precepts designed by men, which would be as changeable as the waves splashing on Plymouth Rock? Does it not behoove us to reconsider what was amazing about these people that gave their blood, sweat, and tears? Does it not cause us to pause and reflect on all so great an inheritance? Psalm 11:3, if the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? The answer is return to the rock from which they were hewn. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.